Hello everyone, today I'm delighted to welcome David Pearce for an interview about his views and transhumanism in general. If you are a follower of this channel, you are probably already acquainted with David and his manifesto, The Hedonistic Imperative, which I have mentioned multiple times in my videos. Hello David, thank you for being with us today. How are you doing?
Hello Christoph, it's very good to be with you.
It's very good to be with you as well. So, to someone who is not familiar with your work or only superficially, how would you summarize the main points contained in it?
Good heavens. Essentially, in The Hedonistic Imperative, which is an online manifesto I wrote back in 1995, I urged the use of biotechnology to replace the biology of pain and suffering with life based on information sensitive gradients of well-being, a kind of new architecture of mind. And one of the things that the revolution in biotechnology and genome sequencing allows is that for all prospective parents, essentially, to choose the genetic makeup of their future children. And essentially, it would already be possible in principle for all prospective parents to choose the approximate pain sensitivity, pain tolerance, and approximate hedonic set point of their future children if they are prepared to allow pre-implantation genetic screening and counseling. Now, obviously, this is quite a radical step compared to traditional sexual reproduction. But basically, unless we tackle our genetic source code, then pain and suffering and misery and depression will continue indefinitely. And one of the things that interests me are people who lie at one extreme end of the scale, so-called hypothymic people today, who have an extremely high hedonic set point, and they can be high functioning, they're not manic, but essentially they go through life animated by information sensitive gradients of well-being. And what I would hope to see, at least as a first step, is that all future beings, starting with all future people, are born with this extremely high, by our standards, hedonic set point. But I think it's worth stressing that much of the suffering in the world, maybe most of the suffering in the world, is undergone by non-human animals, whether in factory farms, slaughterhouses, or in the wild. And non-human animals, a pig for example, is as sentient as well as sapient as a small toddler, and we treat pigs in ways that would get the perpetrator locked up for life if the victim were human. And as I would see the abolitionist project, we should be ending factory farms, slaughterhouses, animal agriculture, and switch to a world in which intelligent moral agents, i.e. us, are systematically helping sentient beings rather than harming them, which, once again, is technically now possible thanks to biotechnology. I can go into more detail later, but you may have one or two questions before I launch into a spiel.
Yes. How would you situate your views in the spectrum of the transhumanist movement? Are your views popular within the movement, or are they still fringe ideas? Maybe they are radical even for transhumanists.
Essentially, I mean, the transhumanist declaration of 1998, reaffirmed in 2009, commitment to the well-being of all sentients is Article 7 of 8. And statistically, if I had to guess, I would say it's probably a fair ranking in terms of priority of most transhumanists. Most transhumanists are focused either on superintelligence, this idea of radical intelligence amplification, that a combination of genetic rewrites and in particular AI will enable us to become vastly smarter than existing humans. And the other big strand, as mentioning, of transhumanism, radical life extension, effectively eternal youth, maybe even some kind of quasi-immortality. And the particular strand of transhumanism that most preoccupies me, overcoming the problem of suffering in non-humans and replacing the biology of suffering with life based on gradients of bliss. I'd hesitate to quantify this. Most transhumanists would be broadly supportive, but it's not their main priority, I would say. And sure, if you believe that we're on the, for example, the brink of post-human superintelligence, well, superintelligence will be able to solve the problem of aging, the problem of suffering, and goodness knows what else. Whereas I'm more skeptical of timescales here. But in terms of a crisp, snappy definition of transhumanism, sometimes I say super intelligence, super longevity, and super happiness, a triple S civilization. And although there are tensions between these ideas, nonetheless, I see them as compatible.
Yes, I think so also. So in your work, I saw that you were concerned about the prospect of how will we convince religious people to be on board with the abolitionist project. And this is something I have, it is a problem I have encountered myself, because I have some discussions with Catholic people here in Belgium or in France, and in their vast majority, they are very much opposed to it. And one concern I have is that the project, the abolitionist project, which you laid out in your manifesto, which I agree totally with, is very akin to the prophecies of the Bible, the end of suffering, the end of death, the end of predation, which is prophesied in Isaiah. And one thing that religious people, one problem that they will have with it is that it is, they will say it is immanentizing the eschaton, that is, humans will bring about the paradise that in their view only God can bring about, and to them it is kind of sacrilegious. So I don't know if you already encountered this rebuttal from religious people, and how would you respond to it?
Yes, I said, rather than engaging in theological discussion, wherever possible, I think we should be aiming to build bridges, win hearts and minds, and consensus. And as you said, I mean, the Bible, for example, Isaiah, yes, it prophesies a peaceable kingdom, a world where the lion and the wolf lie down with the lamb. And it is only possible to create such a world with, at the very least, a little bit of genetic tweaking. I mean, the Bible doesn't specify precisely how this is going to happen. Genetic engineering, CRISPR, and so forth allow us to reprogram predators, use cross-species fertility regulation, and the like. So, yes, you can see anticipations of the transhumanist project in the Bible. In the case of, is this humans playing God? Well, yeah, it's just anyone who chooses to have children is conducting a unique and unprecedented genetic experiment. And the difference with pre-implantation genetic screening, counseling, and soon CRISPR genome editing is that it will be possible to actually load the genetic dice in favor of your future children. And I mean, the Bible doesn't contain any prohibition against the use of pre-implantation screening or counseling or genome editing. I mean, yes, we could, in spite of this new technology, choose to conserve, you know, terrible genetic diseases, cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs, Huntington's, and so forth. We could also choose to conserve the horrors of depression, which has very high genetic loading. But with power comes complicity. Essentially, we're going to be able to choose the level of suffering in the living world, both in humans and in non-humans. And though God may be inscrutable and we can discuss whether or not he exists or not, nonetheless, everyone, almost everyone, is agreed that God is a compassionate, all-merciful God. And what would an all-merciful, all-compassionate God want us to do with this new technology? Would he want us to conserve pain, misery, suffering, or instead use it to ensure the well-being of all sentience? And if mere mortals can envisage the well-being of all sentience, yeah, I mean, God with much greater compassion. I mean, it's almost sort of was blasphemous to suggest that his benevolence is somehow less you know less than humans. So okay, I'm not a believer myself, and this as I said, I feel somewhat uncomfortable when it comes to theological speculation. But that's the line I would generally take.
Okay. Well, and to and another point of confrontation that I have in trying to defend the abolitionist project is it comes from people who have an environmentalist sensibility, and this points to the a kind of tension between different ethical frameworks. For instance, in the hedonistic imperative, the ethical framework is clearly centered around sentient beings. They are endued with a intrinsic value. But of course, you do not consider that ecosystems or species have intrinsic value and must be conserved if it impedes on the well-being of sentient beings. But in the ecocentric ethical framework, which is the foundation of environmentalism, these abstract entities, ecosystems, species, are seen as organic worlds that should have rights in themselves and should be preserved. And so this is something that I've encountered as a kind of tension with the environmentalist movement. It is that most people who are sensible to these ideas, they are kind of revolted by the idea of getting rid of predation, changing whole ecosystems, global ecosystems. They will tend to say, "Well, it's natural, so it's a good thing, or we shouldn't intervene." Or maybe they will say, "Okay, this is maybe bad for the animals, but humans have done so much evil in it. They have been so destructive towards the natural world that we shouldn't intervene because it will bring more harm than good." So I don't know if you have seen this kind of contradiction between.
Yes, once again, rather than tackling environmentalists head on, I would normally emphasize the scope for compromise in that, yeah, I'm personally skeptical that taxonomic abstractions like species or ecosystems have any independent existence. But if one is prepared to adopt an approach of compassionate conservation, one can retain approximations of, you know, existing so-called charismatic megafauna, but just with a little tweaking, and use fertility regulation rather than starvation, predation, and disease to regulate population sizes. So yeah, it depends just how strict environmentalists want to be in conserving the status quo. I mean, if it's the kind of environmentalist who is completely indifferent to the suffering of non-human animals, then one has probably got limited scope for consensus. But if the environmentalist does allow that we should give some weight to the individual well-being of free living animals in nature, then yeah, it's possible to sketch out how with kind of cross species fertility regulation via everything from immunocontraception to tunable gene drives to a bit of light tweaking of existing predators to essentially have a living world that is a kind of pan-species welfare state. Now, a critic now is likely to say, look, you want to turn the whole living world into a zoo, but non-humans are like humans in the sense that just as humans tend to flourish best when free-living but neither wild nor incarcerated, the same can be said of non-human animals too. So although in one sense this is getting ahead of ourselves, before we can seriously tackle the problem of suffering in nature, we need to stop systematically harming non-humans in factory farms and slaughterhouses. Beyond then, yes, I think we're going to need a debate, serious debate about the long-term future of non-human animals, ecosystems. Are we going to have another kind of 540, you know, million years of pain and suffering and sentient beings hurting, harming and killing each other? Or do we want a civilized ecosystem in which all sentient beings can flourish without being physically molested and indeed can be actively helped?
Yes, the reason I'm saying this is because this has already been discussed by environmentalist philosophers like Calicut and others who say they explicitly reject the idea of trying to intervene to impeach predation, because they say this is a crucial component of ecosystems, and they say, well, ecosystems have intrinsic value, and it's wrong to try to dismantle them. And this is maybe the most academic part of the argument, but people, general layman people who are concerned about the environment tend to agree with that view. And that's why I asked the question, because I don't know myself how we can convince these people, because they are explicitly against it.
I mean, this is it. Well, I would then want to probe, are they opposed, for example, to getting rid of vector-borne disease in sub-Saharan Africa, like malaria, for example? Because essentially, if we wipe out malaria, we will be disrupting ecosystems. Yeah, it has been estimated, I didn't believe this when I first came across the figure, malaria is estimated to have killed around half the humans who've ever lived. And essentially that's because malaria used to be much more widespread, and it essentially killed large numbers of very small children. By getting rid of smallpox, for example, hundreds of millions of people who would never otherwise lived, have survived. Now, sure, getting rid of smallpox, essentially it disrupted ecosystems, but nonetheless we recognize that this is a price worth paying, and I would draw this lesson more generally. Essentially, it would be extremely racist to say that, look, it's okay getting rid of malaria in Europe, but we shouldn't be intervening in sub-Saharan Africa. Likewise, it's speciesist to say that we shouldn't be helping non-humans, because it's a frightful way to die, whether in the being asphyxiated, disemboweled, eaten alive, or starving to death, which is the most common way non-humans die. It is brutal.
Yes, I agree. I tend to try to show the contradictions in the ethical framework that they lay out, but it's very difficult. And this is because it touches on much more deep psychological issues in people, and that's the next question that I wanted to bring. It's I think there is a deep psychological difficulty in adhering to the abolitionist project, because it requires first to acknowledge the immensity of suffering in the living world, which in itself is a depressing thought, and that is by its very nature, it gives a strong incentive to not be entertained. And it also requires to accept the conclusion that all this suffering is meaningless and has no reason to be preserved. And I found that this runs counter to profound cognitive biases, first and foremost, the just world fallacy. So how can we create massive acceptance of the abolitionist project if humans are psychologically unprepared to entertain the idea that life is filled with meaningless suffering?
Yes, it's a monumental challenge. One way to confront status quo bias is just a thought experiment. Just ask people to imagine we encounter an advanced civilization that has got rid of suffering, and that their lives are based on gradients of intelligent bliss. Sentient beings flourish in their wildlife parks. There's no predation, there's no depression. Essentially, this kind of scenario has been implemented. Now, what arguments would critics use to persuade this advanced civilization that they should revert to the biology of pain and suffering and traditional sexual reproduction via genetic crapshoot and predation and disease and all the ancestral horrors that they have transcended? And I suspect, insofar as they understood the arguments, the advanced aliens would think of critics as being in the grip of some kind of depressive psychosis. And I suspect they'd be right. But yeah, I mean, not everyone is prepared to consider thought experiments, and it is a huge challenge. Yeah, it's interesting that when you see, though wildlife documentaries are very sanitized for the most part, most people, if there's a starving baby elephant, rather than the cameraman just recording the elephant slowly starving to death, most people watching at home say, well, why couldn't the camera crew have fed the poor baby elephant? Essentially, our benevolence needs to be systematized, that every cubic meter of the planet is shortly going to be accessible to surveillance, micromanagement and control. And one can, envisage dystopian scenarios, some kind of global panopticon, something Orwellian, or alternatively, one can use this power and surveillance to ensure that all sentient beings can flourish. But yeah, I don't want in any way to minimize the challenges. If there were global consensus for getting rid of pain and suffering worldwide, it could probably be done in 100 years or so. In practice, that timescale is hopelessly unrealistic. But technically, yeah, it would be feasible. But what we need to do everything from ensure that all prospective parents agreed to use pre-implantation genetic screening and counselling, that everyone, and this I think is slightly more credible, agrees to make the transition to cultured meat and animal products rather than eating meat. And it would also need a broad global consensus for compassionate stewardship of nature and micromanagement of the rest of the living world. So yeah, it's worth drawing up technical blueprints, because only once we realize what is technically possible can we have an ethical debate on whether we should carry out these policies. But at times I can quite see that, you know, anyone who stumbles across these proposals to how, you know, we can reprogram the biosphere to get rid of suffering, it comes across as fanciful. But in spite of being a super pessimist on technical grounds, I think it probably is going to happen eventually.
So you would we should be kind of implementing a reformist agenda instead of trying to convince everyone that life is horrible and we should make a 100-year plan to get rid of suffering?
I would love a 100-year plan to get rid of suffering. I mean, if you think of the World Health Organization definition of good health, complete physical, mental and social well-being. Now, take that literally. That's even more ambitious than what I'm proposing. But essentially, in terms of building political alliances, I'm personally a negative utilitarian. I think our overriding obligation is to minimize and prevent suffering. Most people aren't negative utilitarians, but on some fairly modest assumptions, yeah, getting rid of unnecessary suffering is a good thing to do. All kinds of religious and secular ethical traditions will agree that, other things being equal, it's good to reduce suffering. And yeah, technology essentially makes the level of suffering in the living world an adjustable parameter. And the ability to edit our own source code, it's historically unprecedented. Nature did not design living beings, sentient beings, to be happy for any length of time, but intelligent moral agents can essentially create an architecture of mind based on gradients of bliss. And clearly, well, we have this notion of heaven, the afterlife. Now, I'm not trying to sell any notion of heaven in the sense of a perfect world, but if we are willing to recalibrate the hedonic treadmill, that's the set of negative feedback mechanisms that stop most people being very happy or very unhappy for long. If we lift hedonic range and hedonic set points, essentially, it's possible to conserve your existing core values and preferences, but do so from a much higher baseline of well-being. Though it's a bit of a mouthful talking about life based on information-sensitive gradients of well-being or bliss, it's worth stressing this, because just imagine waking up in the morning in an exceptionally good mood. I mean, you'd still have your core values and preferences intact from something as trivial, well, I say trivial, as your football team to your relationships and so on, but your default level of well-being could be much higher. And if we are prepared to do a bit of genetic tweaking, it'll be possible to essentially this kind of hedonic uplift without forcing anyone, or not almost anyone, to give up their existing core values and preferences. I say almost anyone, because there are some people who are in principle opposed to any kind of tampering with what is natural. But it's quite striking how critics, I mean, they wear clothes, they have the latest iPhones, look around, and they live in a nice civilized flat. People who romanticize nature, they don't tend to be especially keen on too much of it for themselves.
Yes, indeed. Another concern that I have with genetic tweaking, as you said, is if we consider that the purpose of transhumanism is to get rid of the Darwinian malware encoded in our genome, could it be that the individual freedom of parents with respect to the choice of psychological traits for their future children, which will be informed by the sinister Darwinian malware that corrupts their minds, will be an impediment to the 3S project, super happiness, super intelligence, super longevity? Will parents want their children to be free of suffering? Could they choose children who are more likely to be manipulative and cunning, which is a highly rewarding strategy in a Darwinian setting, but is ultimately socially destructive? What I want to say is, in more abstract terms, it is possible, if not likely, that parents will choose to select for their children the traits that they selected in their partners. But we know that sexual selection is not socially optimal. It favors traits that are antisocial. So do you think this could be a problem, or will parents opt out of consciously selecting for traits that are known to be socially detrimental, which is an option that they don't have in the context of sexual selection, because it's in large part an involuntary decision? Or do you think that legislation will have to be enforced in order to prevent parents from designing their children in a way that will be socially destructive?
Good heavens. Well, there will have to be some kind of legislative framework. What form it takes, huge issue. Let's start with the good stuff. I think most parents will want to have children with high hedonic set point, not prone to depression, high pain thresholds. That would seem relatively straightforward. If you accept the principle that, yeah, life shouldn't be a genetic crapshoot, and that if one can load the genetic dice, one should choose, yeah, essentially, children predisposed to be happy, to be healthy, then, yeah, essentially, almost all parents will want to choose children with a high hedonic set point. Other things being equal, having a happy child is picking a winner. It seems that the evolutionary origins of depression or predisposition to depression lie in the African savannah. This idea that depression is associated with subordination, defeat, keeping one's head down, and yeah, so that's the good stuff. One of the pitfalls, though, is that prospective parents are also likely to want to have smart children. Now, the first CRISPR babies were born, as you know, in China a couple of years ago. Now, the official story was that the twins in question were created with this genetic modification that would confer resistance to HIV. But in so-called animal models, the genetic deletion in question actually enhances intelligence, memory, cognitive performance. And the rogue scientist in question was almost certainly trying to create essentially smart babies with HIV as a cover story. Now, if prospective parents are going to be wanting to boost the intelligence of their kids, I think they're most likely to focus on traditional measures of intelligence like IQ, SATs scores. And it's a very, very narrow and restrictive conception of intelligence. IQ tests measure only the so-called autistic mind-blind component of intelligence. And in your question, you mentioned the possibility of would some prospective parents wanting to choose perhaps Machiavellian children. But other things being equal, parents choosing alleles, allelic combination associated with high IQ, i.e. intelligence in the typical narrowly defined sense, children born with a high IQ, AQ, that's autism spectrum component, are actually less likely to be deviously Machiavellian. It's the opposite problem to what you touched on, that people who are high on the AQ spectrum tend to be more sort of Asperger's, mathematicians, engineers. They find deception, social cognition difficult. So rather than selecting proto super Machiavellian offspring, I think prospective parents are more likely to be selecting for high IQ, AQ. They're linked. Sorry, I'm using jargon. AQ is this idea. It's particularly associated with Simon Baron Cohen. Is essentially autism spectrum disorder is a continuum, and that's essentially you can take this test, and it's a matter of cognitive style whether you have a hyper-systematizing autistic cognitive style or whether you have an empathetic cognitive style. And the kind of cognitive ability measured by IQ tests are mind-blind. IQ tests don't measure prowess in cooperative problem-solving, mind-reading, perspective-taking, empathetic intelligence. And there are neurological trade-offs, and any attempt to boost intelligence in the IQ sense is likely to lift AQ too.
Yes, but that's what I'm wondering. It's will parents indeed choose to augment the IQ AQ of their children, or will they choose to augment their the what I would call the superficial charm component of intelligence, which is more sexually selected, but I don't know if parents will choose to consciously choose that over.
It's very easy, particularly if one is, you know, in the context of conversation or a podcast, to sound like a crude genetic determinist. And in practice, it is much harder to boost intelligence, intellectual performance, and complex traits like that. Much harder to do so than something like, for example, choosing the approximate pain sensitivity of your future child. There's the so-called volume knob for pain, the SCN9A gene. And simply by choosing a benign version of SCN9A, you can give your child an extremely high pain tolerance. You can turn pain into just a useful signaling mechanism. And likewise, even a handful of interventions can boost hedonic range and hedonic set point, but trying to create super genius babies with existing human genomes, the only way I know to do this reliably would be cloning super geniuses with variations. Existing parents, they could use pre-implantation genetic screening, counseling, a little bit of genome editing, but it's not as though there is, you know, just a couple of genetic knobs to dial and you're going to have a super genius baby or anything. Intelligence is much more complicated. So in the long run, I think not merely will we rewrite ourselves to create super happiness, but also super longevity and super intelligence. But it's going to be a monumental computational challenge. And genes and culture essentially co-evolved. And what's needed is this combination of environmental enrichment together with genetic remediation and enhancement. And yeah, it is an immense computational challenge, as well as a political and social challenge.
Yes, of course, it's not purely genetically determined, but polygenic scores could be, compiled to augment the likelihood of certain traits. So maybe it will not be a 100% probability of having a child with all the traits desired, but I think we could augment the probability by a large margin.
Yes, I agree. It's been known everything ever since sort of twin studies between identical and non-identical fraternal twins that all kinds of traits have a quite high degree of genetic loading, sometimes surprisingly so. And molecular biology is starting to tease out the details. And if you know that a particular allele or allelic combination is associated with, let's say, superior cognitive performance, even by a few percent, then yeah, one can imagine pushy, ambitious parents going for the seemingly intellectually superior option. And yeah, horrendous pitfalls, because who knows what other effects these alleles or allelic combinations will have. And the natural reaction of anyone listening to this is that, you know, horrendously complicated, all kinds of things can go wrong. But we already know this with having children. And I'm personally a soft antinatalist. I'm not convinced it's ethically permissible to bring more life into suffering in the world. But most people think they are entitled to have children, even though it will involve a lot of suffering, on the grounds that if they're lucky, life brings a lot of joy too. But it's clearly an almighty gamble having a child. So I think any prospective parent really has an obligation to load the genetic dice if humanly possible.
Yes, and I also was wondering if you, what is your position on, what we are talking about here is biological modification. So it is transhumanism through biotechnology. But what if we could get rid of all these DNA-based life forms and transfer our consciousness into computers? I don't know if you think it's possible. Would it be a better way to quote unquote start anew without the DNA based life that we have and that we know is kind of messy by its nature?
Yes, I mean, couple of points there. First, there is one kind of enhancement that's prefigured by Neuralink that I think is highly likely to become widespread. That with an implant, it'd be possible to have kind of narrow super intelligence on a chip. Just imagine the mature successors of Elon Musk's Neuralink, and yeah, essentially all the things that classical digital computers to do, you're going to be able to do and more with a neurochip. But that is quite different from the kind of scenario that some transhumanists, not me, but some transhumanists have envisaged, which is the idea that we leave our perishable biological substrates behind and upload ourselves, i.e. in some ways scan, digitize and upload to silicon, to make a transition to a different medium. Now, I personally think that this is technically possible, impossible in principle, that I don't think classical digital computers, classical Turing machines can solve the binding problem, that digital computers are effectively zombies or micro-experiential zombies. What is the binding problem in this context? Imagine replacing the ones and zeros of a classical Turing machine with discrete pixels of experience. I said this is a fanciful example. Then execute the code, regardless of how complex the code or how fast you execute the program. All you have is then a micro-experiential zombie. That's digital computers are not subjects of experience. They have no phenomenal binding. Now, how it is that biological minds from worms to mice to humans are capable of supporting the unity of consciousness, the unity of the self, is an unsolved mystery. I've thought and written about it, but nonetheless, essentially it is a given right now that you are a unitary subject of experience, experiencing multiple perceptual objects as part of a unitary self. You're not simply 86 membrane bound pixels of neuronal experience, but somehow a unified subject. And classical digital computers, yes, they're getting faster and faster and their code is becoming more sophisticated, but they're not going to wake up and become subjects of experience. And it's not going to be possible to upload ourselves into silicon. And even if it were, i.e. contrary to what I've just been arguing, the question would then be, what about organic beings like us in basement reality? Are we assuming destructive uploading? Are we assuming that essentially biological creatures are somehow going to be exterminated in the process? This seems unlikely. In short, mind uploading, I don't think it's possible. And even if it were possible, there would still be the problem of suffering and basement reality. So I think it's a distraction.
And do you think it's impossible for physicalist reasons, or is there is something more to it?
Yeah, I'm personally a physicalist. A physicalist essentially argues that the mathematical straitjacket of physics is, for all practical purposes, I'm ignoring complications, complete, that no element of reality is missing from the mathematical formalism of physics. All the special sciences, molecular biology, chemistry, can ultimately be reduced to physics. Now, the actual intrinsic nature of the physical, the fire in the equations, is a controversial subject. If you're a materialist, you'll assume that the fire in the equations, the intrinsic nature of the physical, is non-experiential. If you're a non-materialist physicalist, which is an idea I take seriously, you'll think that the intrinsic nature of the physical could actually be experiential. But all physicalists agree that essentially nothing is missing from the equations of physics. And that, though, leads to the mystery of how phenomenal binding is possible. And because, at least on a naive understanding, if a neuroscientist, neurosurgeon, what have you, does sort of scans your brain, essentially, if you perceive a perceptual object, neuroscanning can detect the existence of edge detectors, motion detectors, color mediating neurons firing. but there doesn't seem to be a unified perceptual object. I mean, this is the binding or combination problem. Discussing it would probably take us too far afield. I'm very happy to do so. But yeah, my reasons for more than skepticism, disbelief that we're going to be able to upload ourselves into silicon. It's not just idle skepticism. There are principled reasons for doubting. I mean, just consider chess program Deep Blue. Deep Blue can outperform humans at chess, but it's not like anything to Deep Blue, nor would it actually make Deep Blue play better chess, actually painting on textures of Qualia, or even if Deep Blue were a subject of experience. In some ways the computer metaphor of mind has been very fruitful, and in some ways it's useful to think of classical digital computers as being intelligent, but they're zombies, or maybe micro-experiential zombies. Organic minds, organic wetware, essentially can solve routinely the binding problem, and our machines don't and can't. Also, I would argue, anyway.
So you would say that the only way to reproduce a sentient being without having a recourse to biological reproduction would be to simply do a molecule cell by cell reconstitution of a biological being?
Yes, I mean, I promise I've no hidden agenda. Some people with, shall we say, unusual views, they have a hidden agenda. But yeah, I'm a physicalist. I believe in the unity of science, and I think if one were to, you know, create your molecular duplicate from scratch, it would be exactly like you. But I don't think it'd be possible to scan your brain and then run the code on a digital computer and create a unified subject of experience. I don't believe that phenomenal binding somehow mysteriously occurs at some level of computational abstraction.
I have other questions. Oh yes, I have two more questions. It is a very big concern for it's a big concern in European countries that transhumanism could be the augmentation technologies could only be available to very rich people, and that it will exacerbate inequality among humanity, and that it's the book of Fukuyama who said that it could bring about a kind of separation of humanity into two species, augmented humans and unaugmented humans. And so the for instance, the French Transhumanist Association is most concerned about how will we make sure that augmentation technologies will be available to everyone. Do you think this is that the inequality concern is valid? It's a valid concern, or will the free market and the rapid decrease of technology price take care of it, or will we have to take more action towards having equal access to these technologies?
In general, I think it's really important to have, you know, social justice, universal basic income, universal access to healthcare and accommodation. Yeah, I can understand the worry that essentially it'll be the Silicon Valley elite, the rich, who benefit from these technologies. But I think, though, the fear is misplaced, that anything that can be digitized, the price just trends inexorably to zero, which is why that your my music collection is just as good as the music collection of Bill Gates and plutocrats. And most relevantly in this context, the price of getting your genome sequenced is collapsing. And essentially that any prospective parent worldwide who wants to have their genome sequenced, who wants to create the pejorative term would be designer baby, essentially will be able to do so. It's extremely cost effective for countries worldwide if there is this kind of transition, a kind of reproductive revolution. More broadly, essentially, the very rich will always be able to have differential access to status goods, positional goods, you know, like only a handful of people can ever own old masters or have beachfront properties. But the substrates of bliss, the substrates of intelligence, they won't need to be rationed. I'm sweeping all kinds of complications and pitfalls under the carpet. But basically, some wonder drug is developed that retards aging or boosts intelligence or safely lifts mood, even if it is protected by a whole raft of patent law and the treatment is extremely expensive. Nonetheless, it would sweep the globe. Transhumanism at its best is for everyone, I would say, for all sentient beings. And that though the rich as always tend to get things first, the lag is being progressively compressed. And that's how I see the benefits of transhumanist technologies.
And the last question was, it's more of a teleological question. Do you think that transhumanism and the success, the victory of the abolitionist project is inevitable? Or do you see human evolution and evolution in general as a kind of inherently unpredictable random walk, and that we have no way of being sure that it will actually take place?
Good heavens. Well, let's consider the three supers: super intelligence, super longevity, and super happiness. Do I think super intelligence is inevitable? Yes, but what is super intelligence? Intelligence is a contested concept. Sticking the word super in front of it isn't especially illuminating. But yeah, I think intelligence amplification is inevitable. I am skeptical of scenarios involving full spectrum machine super intelligence. I think AI is going to augment rather than replace sentient beings. But yeah, ticket off the list. Yes, I see some form of super intelligence as inevitable. Super longevity, radical life extension. Big question here is timescales. I mean, someone like Aubrey de Grey, for example, thinks there's a 50-50 chance that breakthroughs will occur such within the next 15-20 years, such that it'll be possible for existing people to enjoy quasi-immortal lifespan. Wouldn't use the word quasi-immortal, but if effectively, yeah, aging could be a treatable disease. On the other hand, pessimists, and I'm a temperamental pessimist, think that, yeah, it's going to take much longer to defeat aging, which is why anyone who wants to enjoy future transhumanist life should consider signing up for cryonics. But is the defeat of aging inevitable? I think so, just as there's no iron law of nature that says silicon robots can't be replaced and upgraded indefinitely. The same is true for organic robots such as us. The third super happiness, is it inevitable that we're potentially going to phase out the biology of suffering in humans and non-human animals? I would hesitate to to assign a particular creed. But I suspect it is inevitable in the long run, because from our current perspective, from where we are now, essentially a monumental technical, computational, political, sociological challenge. But the advance of science, essentially, it's going to make it easier and easier and easier. And yeah, flash forward to a world in which all prospective parents can choose the level of suffering or approximate suffering of their future children, in which conservation biologists can choose the approximate level of suffering of future non-human animals. What dial settings will they choose? And yeah, I think it's almost inevitable that in the long run, we will phase out all experience below hedonic zero, replace it with information-sensitive gradients of well-being. And that's just the start. That mastery of the pleasure-pain axis will allow the creation of maybe even a kind of super civilization. If today's hedonic range is minus 10 to 0 to plus 10, with minus 10 being abject despair, agony, hedonic 0, emotionally neutral experience, 10 your peak experiences, I can envisage civilizations spanning, let's say, plus 10 to plus 30, but eventually maybe a super civilization of, let's say, plus 90 to a plus 100. And the darkest depths, figuratively speaking, of this super civilization could be far more wonderful than our peak experiences. But timescales, I don't know, but essentially life could be wonderful. But it's up to us to use the technology wisely to make it that way.
And do you see any limitations to that that will be imposed by physical law? Because I know that there was a group of transhumans. I think you were part of it. It's the Order of Cosmic Engineers. And they were saying, science could bring about what humans have imagined throughout history as magic or the supernatural. Do you think this could be envisioned, or are there physical limitations such as thermodynamic death of the universe will
heat death of the universe? Well, cosmology is currently in flux. And what is our ultimate destination? If you're a negative utilitarian like me, you can think that life based on gradients of intelligent bliss, maybe superhuman bliss, is fine. If you're a strict classical utilitarian and you think we have an obligation to maximize the abundance of value, then in theory you're committed to something like a so-called utilitronium or hedonium shockwave, in which where hedonium or utilitronium is matter and energy optimized for pure bliss, and the shockwave is an allusion to its AI assisted velocity of propagation across the cosmos. Now, yeah, that sounds pretty freaky and sci-fi, but yeah, there are technical limits to how much subjective pleasure or bliss that can be compressed in any finite volume. I don't think we really need to worry about them a great deal for now. As I said, I focus much more cautiously, dare one say it conservatively, on the creation of life based on intelligent bliss, rather than considering whether a distant post-human civilization might want to launch a utilitronium shockwave.
Okay. Do you want to add something, or do you have something more to say?
No, Christophe, no, just thanks for inviting me on your show. Yeah, anyone, any follow-ups or anything, I'll do my best to answer. I'm aware of the fact we've only skimmed over as some of the challenges ahead. But yeah, I personally can't. I don't know of anything more morally urgent than getting rid of suffering. And I hope we can, create a triple S civilization of super intelligence, super longevity, and super happiness.
Agreed. Thanks for being on the show. It was a pleasure to have you on the podcast. I will be happy to have follow-ups later, and have a great afternoon, and see you soon, I hope. Bye.